Yes, welcome to Monday Night History. When you think of Tasmania's convict history, the fearsome Port Arthur, of course, tends to spring easily to mind. But before Port Arthur even opened its prison gates, the English had established a convict settlement a little way north on the remote Maria Island. Now, these days, the island's a magnet for bushwalkers who not only stumble across relics from the island's convict past, but also its industrial heyday, which was driven by entrepreneurial Italian businessmen. I'm joined tonight by Kathy Gatenby. Kathy fell in love with the island and its history after living there as a child, and she's published many books and papers about the island's history and its settlers. It is a fascinating story. And she joins us. Kathy, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Phil.
You spent 4 years as a child growing up on the remote island on the bottom of the world. How did you come to be there?
Well, my father was appointed the first ranger on the island. At this time, it had been taken over by the government to establish a wildlife sanctuary there. And he got the job. And we moved from lighthouses then to Maria Island, and eventually it became a national park.
Okay, so what was his job? His job was to do what?
Well, his job was to help with the establishment of wildlife on the island. Mm. So the government was collecting wildlife, and any wildlife that they thought was vulnerable was taken to Maria Island, so as a sanctuary for those species. And they were also had a secret agenda at the time, which was never openly discussed, and that was that they were trying to establish a Noah's Ark, if you like. Mm. So they had somewhere to put the thylacine if they were ever able to find them, and they were actively searching at that time.
Sure. Yeah, it's an island that's defined by its north and south ends, isn't it? It's there are two lumps of the island, and they're connected by this very narrow, low isthmus of sand, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, glorious beaches either side of that isthmus, and it's not a large island. It's only 20 kilometres long and about 13 kilometres at its widest point. So, but it's an extremely diverse island in terms of its geology, its vegetation and wildlife, and that isthmus that you talk about, pristine white sandy beaches. And beautiful clear waters around the island, so it's very popular for swimming and snorkeling. And of course, it's rich in cultural heritage.
Hmm. Yes, it was. I mean, it was occupied by Indigenous people, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. As were all areas of Tasmania.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. When did Europeans come?
Well, it was first explored it was charted, if you like, by Abel Tasman in 1642, and he named it in honour of the wife of the then governor of the Dutch East Indies. And that, of course, was Anthony Van Diemen, and that's where we get Van Diemen's Land from. Mm-hmm. And his wife was Maria. Other explorers have since passed by Maria Island. They glimpsed it or saw it in the distance. But in 1802, a French exploration came this way, commanded by Nicolas Baudin. And their voyage was intent on scientific and observation and research. So what you'll also find all on the east coast of Tasmania, and particularly on Maria Island, are a lot of French names, like Cape Peron, Point Mourget, Riedel Bay, etc. And that was from the French who were there at that time.
Mm. Yes, in 1825, I mean, the English, of course, come in 1788, and although, as you say, they don't land till 1789, but in 1825, they set up a penal settlement on the island. Why did they want to go to a remote outpost like that when life in Tassie was difficult enough as it was?
Yeah, well, by the early 1820s, the population of free settlers in Van Diemen's Land was beginning to overtake the number of convicts in the colony. So, things were shifting. And the government was actively seeking more remote sites in which to establish penal settlements, basically to segregate the convicts from the general population. There was a penal settlement already established on the West Coast, you know, the notorious Sarah Island.
Yes.
And that's where the worst convicts were sent. But Governor Arthur also wanted to establish a second convict colony that was closer to Hobart, isolated and preferably insular, but with the thought that it'd be easier to maintain security with the convicts. So Maria Island was where they sent men who'd been convicted of offences within the colony, and they were sent there to perform hard labour under strict surveillance as their punishment.
So Maria Island actually predates Port Arthur, doesn't it?
It does. Port Arthur wasn't established to 1830. So, you know, we had there were a couple of these convict settlements well underway before Port Arthur.
Yeah, there were two phases to the convict settlement on the island. There was the original one, which closed after 7 years, and the second one lasted 8 years. Gee, it must have been difficult to keep it going. What did they do when they were there?
Well, it was a hive of industry, actually, and remembering that their punishment was hard labour, so they put them to work. By this stage, by 1825, the population of Van Diemen's Land was between 14,000 and 15,000 people, so they needed to become more self-sufficient. And they needed food, clothes, tools, building materials. So the convicts were employed in producing a lot of this for the colony. And during that first period, for example, there was a real emphasis on textiles. So on Maria Island, there were, you know, buildings like a tailor's shop, a cloth factory, weaving shops, a dye house, all focused on providing cloth and woolen products for the government, and also things like shoes and boots, and they had to get thousands of convicts clothed and shod, and plus military and staff.
The trouble is the convicts kept escaping. I mean, it was close. It's relatively close to the mainland. It's relatively close to Tasmania, and it was notorious for escapes, which was one of the reasons in the end they closed it, wasn't it?
Yes, certainly the first convict period on the island, they closed it because they had so many escapes. It was actually quite easy. Convicts weren't known for their swimming ability, but on Maria Island they could easily sort of rig up canoes or rafts. They could nick boats if soldiers weren't paying attention, and all of that, use a log, and they'd make their way to the mainland.
Yeah.
And Tasmania.
Kathy Gatenby is my guest. She grew up on Maria Island. We're talking about the island, an old convict station, of course, off the east coast of Tasmania. All right, so after the convicts have gone by 1850, the island is then leased for farming. And a few years later, a new phase begins, thanks to an Italian-born businessman called Diego Bernacchi. Now, Diego had a great vision, didn't he? What was it?
He did. He fell in love with Maria Island when he first came to Tasmania. His vision was basically wine and silk and tourism, and he also recognised the potential for mining and cement production on the island. And he was a very enthusiastic operator and quite charismatic, so he was able to attract investments for his ventures, and he was good at influencing others. So he also convinced the government to give him a 10-year lease for the island, and his grand vision was to create, and these are in his words, a southern utopia, and that's what he set out to do.
Yes, he was very enthusiastic. He brought workers out from Europe. Even though I grew up in Tassie, I didn't know all this. He brought workers out from Europe. He reused convict buildings. By the end of 1888, there was a population of over 250, for heaven's sake.
Yes.
And the town had been renamed San Diego after, the eponymous name for Diego Bernacchi. So
yes,
he also set up a cement works. What was all that about? It doesn't seem like an obvious place to make cement.
He had an eclectic range of interests, I think. And dare I say, he was Italian. And so, you know, stone and cement is would have been big industries in Italy. So perhaps that was part of the influence. But he sort of dabbled in that first period when he was on the island. He dabbled in this, and he had, you know, he was testing for quality of cement and things like that. And there are still ruins to this day of his first ventures into this with lime kilns, and that people can still see. It's
but there was there an abundance of lime on the island or something, was there?
Yeah, yes, there is. Also, there's anybody who's been to Maria Island has probably visited what they call the Fossil Cliffs, which, of course, is a great source for lime. Mm. And so they were mining the Fossil Cliffs for lime to make cement.
Okay. When you lived on the island, you and your family stayed in the same house that Bernacki lived in, didn't you? What's it like?
Well, when he returned in 1920. He did live in this house for a couple of years. Mm. He certainly had it built in the 1880s. It was a beautiful house. It was a big house, so great for a family. When we got there, it was in ruins, but Dad did it up, so it made it quite habitable for us. It was beautiful. And one of the things I remember, strangely enough, and I think this is reflective of Bernacki's taste, was the toilet, which was a porcelain bowl with flowers all over it. Okay. It was beautiful, a Victorian porcelain water closet, if you like, very beautifully illustrated with flowers all over it. And people, the word got out, and people would knock on our door and ask to photograph our toilet.
Yes, the whole, well, Bernacki's basically scheme all came to naught in the end, didn't it?
Mm. Yeah, it did. He in the first period he was there in the basically all of the 1880s. By the time you got to the 1890s, we had the collapse of the Van Diemen's Land Bank, a depression that was pretty much global. And also there was a terrible drought in Australia at the time. So all of these things took their toll, and he went bust, basically, and ended up leaving and going back to England. But he returned in the 1920s and back to Maria Island, having again established backers and for a cement production, the Portland Cement Works. And they formed a company, and this time around, there was like £600,000 of investment went into this. And Darlington again took off, and this time over 500 people moved to the island to basically work at the cement works, and Darlington became a company town.
Yeah. Yes, for a while before it all fell away again.
Yeah. And by the 1930s, that was all over again. That was the depression, and Bernacki died in 1925, and that was the peak of production for the cement works. And I like to think that he died thinking he finally backed a winner. He was not to know.
Yes.
And of course that went bust.
That's
as well.
Right. The depression killed it all off. And by the 30s through to the 60s, it was just really a very dwindling population of farmers and fishers, wasn't it, before it became a wildlife sanctuary in 1968.
That's right. And, yes, as you said, dwindling, the services that were on the island, shops and post office and all those things, eventually closed down. So the people who lived there were more and more reliant on boats bringing stores to the island for them.
When you lived there, you became fascinated with an abandoned house you stumbled across at the very southern tip of the island. And you discovered that we probably don't use the word hermits anymore, but they almost were, weren't they? A couple lived there in that remote spot for 40 years, hardly saw a soul.
Yeah, that's right. And it was the last farm on the island that was acquired by the government when they were taking it over to become a wildlife sanctuary, and the only house on the south end of the island. So it was quite remote. And it took us the best part of the day to get there. And Dad had to secure the property and basically clean the place out. But what fascinated me, I was only seven, was that it looked like the people who lived there just popped out for a while. So kind of felt a bit wrong to be in their house uninvited, poking around all their things. But most of their belongings were still there, their chairs, you know, either side of the fire, books and letters and papers, all the kitchen pots and pans.
What has happened to them?
Well, of course, the people who lived there, Viv and Hilda Roby, they were long gone.
They walked out, had they?
Well, Hilda had died about in the early 60s, and Viv Roby, her husband, he carried on there for another, you know, 4 or 5 years before his health became so bad and someone took him off the island. And so that's why the house was pretty much left the way it was. And I was always curious about who they were and what brought them to such an isolated place. So about 10 years ago, I took some time off work and did some research, and I found a wonderful story, a story that I think is a love story, and I ended up publishing it, and it's called Viv and Hilda.
Yes, remarkable. All right. These days, of course, you can. It's a great place for people who bushwalk, don't they? And and walk the island. It's it's a world. Of course, Darlington's now a World Heritage Site.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, for the probation station.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, Kathy. Been fascinating. Thank you for telling us about it and being our guide tonight to Tasmania's Maria Island.
Oh, you're welcome, Phil. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.